21st century has ushered in events and issues that cause us to ask, where is God in today's world? In response, Dallas Theological Seminary presents DTS Dialogue, Issues of God and Culture, The Chronicles of Narnia. The first major motion picture of C.S. Lewis' epic series has swept the nation and has drawn attention to the significance of biblical themes in contemporary cinema. Join us as we examine some theological and cultural implications of The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Part 1.
Welcome to another edition of Dallas Seminary Podcast. I am joined here at the table by Dr. Daryl Bach, who is the Research Professor of New Testament Studies and Professor of Spiritual Development and Culture. Across from Dr. Bach is Dr. Hall Harris. Dr. Harris is Professor of New Testament Studies. To his left is Dr. Glenn Kreider, Professor of Theological Studies in the Theological Studies Division. My name is Mark Yarbrough. I'm the Executive Director of Communications at Dallas Theological Seminary. The topic that we are going to be discussing today is Narnia and C.S. Lewis and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Just some stats, gentlemen, to start off. Obviously, this movie was released here in the United States on December the 9th. It did about $70 million, almost that, second behind Harry Potter, which had been out a few months before that. The total U.S. gross to date is $122 million. Globally, it has taken in about $200 million. Obviously, many people are going to watch this movie, and many people will be seeing it in the days ahead. So, it brings up a lot of questions about C.S. Lewis, the theology of C.S. Lewis in the movie itself, and how authentic it is in relationship to the book. And this is one that I can say that I have actually read the book before seeing the movie, like many other people, and so that's what we're going to talk about. Dr. Harris, I'm going to punt the first question to you, if you don't mind, and let's look at the great question of who is C.S. Lewis and what is the general storyline of the series of The Chronicles of Narnia?
Well, it might be more effective to ask the question, who is C.S. Lewis in the UK and who is C.S. Lewis in America? Because it has been said more than once that it's almost as if you're dealing with two individuals. As far as the UK, United Kingdom, Lewis was an intellectual. He was an academic. He spent his entire professional career at the universities of Oxford and Cambridge, ended up as a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature, started out as a tutor in the university system, which is, it's difficult to describe that. In the American system, there's no real equivalent, but it's sort of like a private teaching assistant who's hired by students to help them prepare for exams and write essays and critique their work. And eventually, Lewis gained faculty status and spent his entire life basically in the academic field. He was particularly interested in Renaissance and medieval literature, which was his specialty, but he was extremely widely read, remembered virtually everything he read, and was able to comment on lots and lots of different things. Now, C.S. Lewis started out as an atheist and became a Christian in the 1930s, largely under the influence of J.R.R. Tolkien, famous in the U.S. for being author of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Lewis, after his conversion to Christianity, began to write apologetic works, essays, and other pieces, which some of which were broadcast over the BBC. And during the Second World War, he actually went around and spoke at various military bases, notably RAF stations, talking to the troops and sort of giving basic introduction to Christian theology. Shortly after the Second World War, Lewis began to be more involved in fiction, and the fiction is what he is perhaps better known for in the States. He did a series of seven children's books known as The Chronicles of Narnia. He also did a set of three books that are more what we would call science fiction that go under the general title of the Space Trilogy. It's Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. And those books have continued to be popular, along with some of Lewis's apologetic works like Mere Christianity, God in the Dock, The World's Last Night, and other essays. There's a whole string of those that he wrote. And then in addition to the Christian writings, he did a number of professional writings as well, like literary essays and The Allegory of Love and a number of other Discarded Image, a number of more technical works within his field that are not very well known in the U.S. So that's who C.S. Lewis was in a nutshell.
Now, that's who he is in the U.K. Who is he in America?
Oh, yes. I forgot about that point. Thank you for reminding me, Daryl. Lewis in the U.S. has become sort of a hero of the faith, inducted almost into Hebrews chapter 11, you might say, as by evangelical Christians in the U.S., where he is generally widely respected for his apologetics, in particular, particularly his logical and rational approach to defending the Christian faith, right, in his arguments for the genuineness of the Christian faith.
And why do you think that is? I mean, we've all done it. Everybody sitting here at this table, we've quoted C.S. Lewis. He's shown up in lectures and sermons. Why is that?
Well, one of the reasons is because he's so quotable. He has a way of taking complex issues and boiling them down into a very into a soundbite, and so he's full. I spent a little bit of time this morning looking at a couple of websites that have just page after page after page after page of quotations. He's just very quotable. Yeah. He says what we would all like to say very clearly and succinctly in a way which is what makes him very effective in modern apologetics, is that he has a really nice way of demonstrating the logical inconsistency of other views and painting Christianity as the reasonable, rational alternative.
Yeah, an example of that, I think, is the famous thing that probably all of us have heard, that Jesus is liar, lunatic, or bored,
right,
which actually is a boil down of a passage in Mark. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you think, golly, Lewis did this wonderful creative thing on the one hand, saying it, and it, you know, and you kind of think it was a saying ex nihilo out of nowhere, and then lo and behold, you read this passage in Mark, and you go, that's where he got it.
And he follows up on those themes on a regular basis. My other favorite, he's either on the level of someone who claims to be a poached egg, or he is the Lord of the universe.
That's right.
And they show up all over the place. Well, let's jump right into the movie. I mean, obviously, that's the phenomena that we're dealing with. What is the backdrop of the Chronicles of Narnia? Hall, you mentioned that it was originally released by Lewis as a children's series. What is the backdrop, anybody jump in on this one, of the Chronicles of Narnia, and in particular, the movie that we're talking about, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Well, just to give a really quick summary, the movie and the story, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, on which the movie is based, opens with four English children who have been sent to live in the countryside outside of London to escape the Blitz during the Second World War, the German bombing of London. And so they're living in a large house that's run by an old professor and his housekeeper. The youngest of the four children, a girl named Lucy, discovers in a vacant room an old wardrobe. A wardrobe is a large closet-like mm-hmm. piece of furniture, right, that you stored coats and clothing in. And when she looks into this wardrobe, she finds that it's actually a doorway into another world, the world of Narnia. And it turns out, as she makes her first visit to this other world, that the land of Narnia is under the spell of the White Witch, who has turned the country to eternal winter and never mm-hmm. Christmas. And so the country is populated by talking animals, basically, and they're desperately hoping for the return of their king, who happens to be a lion named Aslan. In the course of the story, it turns out that all four of the children end up visiting Narnia. One of them turns traitor and goes over to the side of the White Witch, and ultimately is rescued only by Aslan himself, substituting himself for Edmund, the traitor, and allowing the White Witch to kill him. So Aslan steps into Edmund's place and dies in his place, and then is resurrected. And of course, there's a big battle scene at the end where the White Witch is permanently defeated, and everything is put right in the end. That's a basic summary.
Okay, now with that basic summary, one of the great questions that is often asked is this to be understood as an allegory to the Bible? How would you approach that particular topic?
It seems clearly to be the case that the film and the story are allegorical. The question would be whether Lewis intended to write an allegory of the Christian story, and his own testimony leads us to question that. The story develops, the story originated in his own attempt to provide entertainment for children who stayed in his house during the war. And he had these images in his mind about this world, and he begins to tell the story, and the story develops. I think in order to understand Narnia, you have to understand that Narnia is a real world. It's not a real world, but it is a real world. And in order to understand the world of the story, you have to understand the diegetic world that Lewis constructs. And because Lewis is a Christian, because he is immersed in the biblical symbolism and literature, because he's immersed in the language and the images of the text, they show up in his world. But whether it's legitimate to read, and I think I would caution against doing that, reading the story alongside of the biblical story and trying to do a one-for-one correspondence throughout the story.
Yeah. What is a diegetic world?
It's the world. It's the world. I have a handful
it's
of
a world
words.
On a diet.
I have a handful of technical terms I like to drop into conversation. The diegetic world is the world created by the story, it is the world of the story. It's the world of the film. It's the world of a piece of literature. And in order to understand the story, one has to understand the world that is constructed by the author, by the storyteller.
So how the characters interact and how and the nature of the reality that's being portrayed and all that kind of
thing. In the world in which you and I live, animals don't talk. When we engage in warfare, you don't have flying hippos and those kind of
things. You haven't been in my house.
In Narnia.
So in other words, if this world existed, how would the biblical story have enacted itself in that world? Is that safe to say?
Lewis said that the question he's trying to answer is how would God incarnate himself in Narnia? And Aslan obviously, Aslan is Jesus. Obviously, the lion metaphor, the lion symbolism is the point. But in order to understand Narnia, that's Lewis's intention. How would God incarnate himself and address the problem in this world? Now, because in the meta-narrative of the creation, fall, and recreation. That's the big story, the organizing motif.
The meta-narrative.
There you go again.
The big
story.
Okay. Gotcha.
So in that story, which is the relationship between the creator and his creation, whether that story takes place in the world that we know or in a fantasy world that Lewis creates or Tolkien creates, there are similarities between those worlds, so that there's always, in every good story, I think it's not even just a good story. Every story has a problem that needs to be resolved. There is peril. There's a need for redemption and salvation. And that God, in Lewis's story, enters into the world of Narnia as Aslan, and he is the one who makes things right. He's the one that restores order and restores truth and the creator's design for that world.
Okay. Before we get into some of the specifics, and you'd mention, obviously, the character of Aslan, and we'll talk about that, what are some of the differences between the book and the movie? I mean, that's the age-old question of how can you take any book and have it into a movie? And to some degree, especially as we're dealing with this topic, I mean, it's the great question that was asked with the Passion of the Christ. And how can you take a story and relay it. What are some of your thoughts on that as you've seen the movie now?
I'd like to hear Hall address some of the specifics, but one of the things that must be said, I think, is that when you move from a story, when you move from a piece of literature into a film, much of the narrator's ability to communicate what is actually going on in the thought life of people is missed, is gone. Mm, yeah. And so what the filmmaker does, either communicate that through facial expressions or other characters' descriptions, but you really have to guess at what's going on in the characters' minds. And there's so much, the great strength of Lewis, that in these stories he tells us a lot of what the characters are thinking, which you don't see in the film,
right.
Because it's by very nature of the genre.
Sure.
Well, there, as far as major differences, some of the most noticeable things would be, first of all, there's a fairly extensive introduction that starts with a German bombing attack on London that shows the children running for an air raid shelter and trying to escape, and then they're put on the train and sent out to the professor's house in the country. Lewis opens the book with one sentence: there were four children who were sent away to the country to escape the air raids. This is understandable because modern audiences, when Lewis wrote the book, everybody knew what was going on in London in 1940. So obviously changes like that are necessary to give a little backstory and fill in details. There, some of the other problems that you run into when you go to the medium of film is you have to keep things moving along very, very rapidly. And one of the big problems that confront directors and script writers of films is how to move characters from place to place when you're in widely separated locales.
Right.
So, for example, when the children and Mr. and Mrs. Beaver are escaping from the Beaver's house to get away from the White Witch's wolves, who are her secret police, they go through this tunnel and come out somewhere else, and it brings them to where they need to be. That tunnel is not in the book. It's a device that was added into the film to move
from
characters from A to B. Then there's the other idea that in order to hold a modern audience's interest, you have to have an action movie. And so there are some scenes, which I would say are almost throwaway, which are put in there for the sake of increasing the danger, the action. This would be the waterfall crossing the river scene where the ice flow breaks up and the children go washing down the river on a chunk of ice. And then when they're pushed to land by the beavers who, you know, shove the ice, you know, block along to the shore, Peter's left holding Lucy's coat, and for a few dreadful seconds, Susan and Peter think that Lucy has been drowned and washed away, and she comes walking in from the side saying, "Has anyone seen my coat?" None of this is in the book. This is all added in. Probably the other single most biggest and obvious thing is the final battle scene at the end, which obviously, since many of the special effects were done by the same company in New Zealand that did Lord of the Rings, there are lots of similarities anybody who's seen both of those films can detect in the creatures and the way they move, and then particularly the size of the relative armies, because in Lewis's book he only devotes really a handful of sentences to describing the last battle. And it's obviously because he thinks it's a children's book. In fact, earlier at one point when he's describing Aslan's trip to the Stone Table, which is where he's going to die, to be killed by the White Witch, Lewis actually in the book has a little aside that he makes that I can't really describe all these horrible creatures that are here because if I did, your parents wouldn't let you read this book. Well, in the movie, I'm afraid most of those creatures are there in all their hideous special effects glory. And the battle scene itself is much bigger in scope than I think Lewis would have envisioned, probably a few hundred, you know, fighting on each side. In this battle scene in the movie is a cast of thousands.
Well, I think that's an example of where you see you're moving from a literary genre to a video genre, and you're used to certain things. And you've mentioned the Lord of the Rings, but the other scene that came to mind when I hit the battle scene was with the Star Wars movies and some of the conflict that you see there with the special effects and that kind of thing. It's it's an interesting phenomenon. And actually, I think that there was actually concern about the level of the violence in the film for the children who would go to see it.
Right.
And, you know, and I think it's also probably a little bit of a difference between perhaps Europe and the United States, in the sense that Europe tends to downplay issues of war, having experienced war as it has, whereas the United States tends to have movies that go in this direction very, very easily. And so I think that you're seeing all kinds of cultural things in those moments where you get those differences. But I have to say that it certainly adds a pop to the film. I don't know if you had a short battle scene, if you would have the same effect in film that you would have. But you can handle it more crisply in a book because people can imagine it.
Right.
But now you have to visualize it on film.
For more information about Dallas Theological Seminary, please visit our website at www.dts.edu.